This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can think of my guest as a character actor in a crime story, but the crimes were real, and so were the criminals. Vincent Murano was an undercover cop in the New York City Police Internal Affairs Division. From 1976 to 86, it was his job to investigate police officers suspected of armed robbery, drug trafficking, blackmail, arson, and murder. Murano often posed as mobsters and hitmen. He has a new book about his undercover work called Cop Hunter. Murano became a cop in 1965. He got involved in investigating police corruption through Bob Lucy, the cop whose story was told in the film Prince of the City. After Lucy exposed corruption on the force, he needed protection. Murano was his bodyguard. And Murano saw firsthand how a cop who testified against another cop was despised. I asked Vincent Murano if cops hate him now because he served in internal affairs.
Probably most of them. That's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, too. It just bothered the hell out of me. You know, why I constantly had to make excuses, and my wife had to make excuses. You know, what does your husband do for a living, or what did he do? Well, he worked in the police department. Oh, that's very nice. What a nice job. Where did he work? He worked in the Internal Affairs Division. Oh, how awful. Oh, my God, that's terrible. He locked up his brother officers. See, these are the kind of remarks that I would get, or my wife would get. And that's bull, because I locked up criminals that happened to be policemen, and you know, policemen should know about the type of work that I did. My family should be proud of what I did. No policeman wants to be riding in a police car next to someone who hired me to kill somebody. And that policeman who says that he doesn't care, there's something wrong with him. I mean, that's the way I feel.
So what were the typical crimes that you'd go after?
Well, it's one of the problems with the Internal Affairs Division, and I say that in the book, because there's so many types of corruption, you know, from everything from a sandwich for free, or for we call shoppers who look for bargains, to cops, you know, who hired me to murder someone. That's all investigated in the Internal Affairs Division. And you know, I worked on very serious cases where I was arresting criminals that happened to be policemen. Types of cases were cases like the Coleman case, which I was very proud of that case. And I wanted other policemen to know about this case. Coleman was a police officer, and he worked with another police officer named Ron Lohr. That's the irony of that. His name was Lohr, L-A-W. And they actually sold me, and I was posing as an organized crime hitman and a criminal. They sold me police uniforms. They sold me guns. They sold me badges. They sold me complete disguise so that I could pose as a policeman to enter into a closed jewelry store to do a robbery. They also sold me a radio so that I could monitor where the police were, and I could actually call in and send the police to another part of the precinct to call in a fake, what we call a 1013, which would be a CIS patrolman. These two fellas would do anything for money. They were just two bad guys, and these are the type of people that can infiltrate the police department. These were criminals before they were cops. They were criminals while they were cops, and they're criminals today, I'm sure.
My guest is Vincent Murano, and he's the author of the new book Cop Hunter, which is about his years with New York's Internal Affairs Division investigating corrupt cops. You often went undercover. That was really your specialty. Had that been done much before in internal affairs?
Well, I'm sure that the Internal Affairs Division did have some undercover type things, but not so direct. What I mean by that is, you know, what they considered undercover would be if you were in a bar having a beer, you would be watching something. You would be observing something in the bar go down or a deal take place. To me, that's not undercover. What I did was undercover. What I did was I played many different characters, everyone from a street wino, a bum druggie, to a high-level capo in a crime family. So I hit everything in between, a smuggler, a hitman, many different characters I played, and I actually infiltrated the criminals. I became one of them. And that's how, what I consider undercover. That's really undercover. When you live that life. I lived in an apartment in Mineola and away from my home for a number of months. I always had to make sure I had a car that didn't have license plates that could be traced. I had a phony ID. My name is Vincent Morano. Vincent Morano never existed after 1976 when I went to Internal Affairs Division. My name became Vincent Muccio. Everyone called me Vinnie Moo. There was a criminal record established in the Criminal Records Division. I had a record. I had fingerprints on file. I was a criminal.
Now, when you were undercover, you used something called the Hello Phone, which I've seen on TV and in movies, but I wasn't sure if real people undercover actually used it. Do you want to describe how the Hello Phone works?
Yeah, it's used quite a bit in undercover situations. A Hello Phone is a supposedly untraceable phone that the phone company hooks up for us, where it might be, if you had a connection with the phone company, say, and you said, where is this phone listed to? And it would be a phony address somewhere in maybe Brooklyn or New York or Manhattan. But in fact, the phone was on my desk at the Internal Affairs Division. And I would, and anyone who picked up that phone says hello. They don't say, hello, this is the Internal Affairs Division, because that's the number I would give out as my phone for any of these criminals to contact me. And that's a hello phone. And it's very simple. It's, you say hello when you pick it up. That's it.
So it's like an undercover phone.
Right, exactly, yeah. And that was usually set up, that phone, with a tape recorder attached. Technically it's called an induction coil, but you've seen them. What it really is just a piece that goes over the earphone, and it plugs into the microphone of a tape recorder. And it's hooked into a tape recorder, and whenever the phone rings, you'd hit the button and you'd record. And that's what you do, and that's what that phone was always set up for, just undercover work.
You were also wired a lot. You had a tape recorder on your body often to record the incriminating discussion. Where would you conceal it?
Well, it depends. But most people hesitate to search, even policemen, and to put their hand in your private parts, your genital area. So whenever I felt uncomfortable or I thought I would be searched, I wanted to wear a tape recorder 99% of the time, because it's very important to get that type of evidence when you're working on police corruption. So I would hide the tape recorder, I would tape it to my thigh, or I would tape it in my back sometimes. Sometimes you had to use two types of equipment. There is something called a transmitter, which is usually very small, much smaller, smaller than a pack of cigarettes. I could conceal it much better. And the other reason why you would wear a transmitter is so that people, my backup in the area, would be able to monitor and hear if I was in trouble. They might not be able to save me in time, you know, because they have to get into this place, but at least they'll be knowing when I'm getting bumped off or whatever.
Did you ever position yourself into unusual angle so that the microphone would be pointed in the right direction and you'd be sure to get good sound?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I tell you, sure, you got better as you went along. You know, most of the tapes that I made, I transcribed. And, you know, I got to know by experience how to set myself up in a position to make a good recording, because I'm the one that had to make the transcription. And let me tell you, sometimes a 20-minute conversation, depending on the background noises, if there's a jukebox or dishes clanging, you'll spend 3 weeks transcribing that tape. Because a U.S. attorney or a prosecutor, they don't want you to too many unintelligibles on a transcript. They don't want to see inaudibles. They want that thing transcribed. So, I learned to get, good recordings. I learned if there was a jukebox, like in one case, on the Coleman case, we were sitting next to a jukebox, and all my backup, and I had backup this particular evening, were inside of an Italian restaurant. I made a decision to leave the restaurant. I couldn't tell my backup this. I mean, I just made a decision that I had to take a chance. So I went outside under an awning, and we got a good recording, but I didn't have any backup, but I took that chance. A car is always very good, and if you're sitting in a car and I have the tape recorder and the microphone, say, on my underneath my right armpit or my right shoulder. I could put my arm on the seat and face the person I'm speaking to, and he'll be speaking, he'll be maybe 10 inches right from the microphone. I mean, I used to be able to get great recordings that way.
You say that when you started in the Internal Affairs Division that they really liked to play it by the book. Were there things you wanted to do that weren't by the book?
Yes, I feel that you really had to improvise to a great extent to make the types of cases I made. When you're going after policemen, you really have to use different techniques. I mean, it's very difficult to follow and do surveillance on a policeman who's familiar with that type of techniques.
What's an example of something that you did that wasn't by the book?
Well, one particular case, I was working on two cases actually at the same time. Both of them were, I was playing an organized crime type of person. In one case, I was Vinnie Moo, and in one case, I was Vinnie Cab. I always used my own first name in case I ran into a neighbor or someone, which happened to me. What I did was I actually had, on these two separate investigations, on two separate targets, I had them meet each other in a restaurant with me present. That's something that really isn't, that kind of thing is dangerous because if you blow the case, you could blow two cases. But I actually thought it would work, and it actually did work, and it did help one gangster convince the other gangster that I was a gangster. So I used them against each other.
You used sting sometimes, too.
Yes.
Was that accepted by IAD?
Well, actually, it was. What you call the sting is something that really is technically and legally right to do. Courts have upheld what you mean by a sting as a setup, get someone involved in a robbery. And see, that the key word here is the word of entrapment. If I go to a police officer and say to him, "Do you want to do a robbery with me tonight?" And he says, "Oh, great, let's do it." I mean, or if I say to a police officer, "This is a very easy robbery to do. We're going to go to this place. No one's going to be there. I have the key." Now, this police officer, what he's supposed to do is report this. So how can you entrap a police officer? He's bound by his oath to report this. So it's very difficult for a policeman to prove entrapment.
How would you know which cops were corrupt? Would you have informants who would tell you who was corrupted? Did you go into a case knowing that something was fishy with somebody?
Well, it depends. There are many different types of investigations. But I could tell you right now, I feel very strong about this. The only way to make a really important case is with an informant or a turnaround or someone that's caught. And we use different words, flipped or turned, to tell on other people. I mean, it sounds, maybe it doesn't sound very nice, but that's the name of the business we're in. I mean, we're not here, having a Sunday dinner. I mean, we're here to arrest people that commit crimes. What happens is, in most cases, one case leads to another case. And, and it's a chain reaction.
An important part in making a case is the part that happens in court after the bust is made. How can you possibly testify in court and then go back on the street as an undercover agent?
Happens all the time.
I mean, I just find it so hard to believe that pictures of you don't circulate all around the underworld.
Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, what can I say? It's a big city, and was it 8 or 9 million people? I worked undercover for 15 years, and I never got my cover was never blown. I've testified hundreds and hundreds of hours in trials, and that night I'd be out playing the part of Vinnie Moo, the hitman. I mean, it's incredible, but it's a big city, and I've done it. I did it for 15 years, and I never got one time, actually, when I was working on a case involving the Laurel brothers. I was in a diner, and we were discussing committing a robbery and a burglary. And a neighbor walked in who happened to be a coach on a little league team that I was on with my son. And he come over to the table and he started talking to me about this and that and how you doing, Vinny. And It was a very scary moment, but I convinced this neighbor of mine to leave, and when I got him alone in the bathroom, I said to him, look, go away. You don't know what I'm doing here. I couldn't go into too many details, but here's this heavy-duty criminal sitting there discussing a robbery, and here's my neighbor coming over to talk about Little League.
There have been a couple of contracts on your life, right, after you've
Yes.
busted people. Now, after one bust, to avoid there being a contract on your life, you said to the guy, look, I'm not an informant or a lieutenant turned informant. I'm from internal affairs. Business is business. You were caught. It wasn't anything personal. Why did you think that telling him that it wasn't anything personal was significant enough to, like, deter him putting a contract out on your life?
Well, the main thing, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about a person... one of my last cases, his name was Nunzio Di Carlo. He was a made man, which means he had to do something to be accepted into organized crime, which could mean he killed someone. Basically, that's what that means. He was a made man. He was a guy that I was dealing with. This is a very unusual role I was playing. Actually, the only time I ever really did this, I was playing the part of a corrupt lieutenant in charge of the narcotics division. And this Nunzio Di Carlo was a soldier, I believe, which is a connected guy involved with the Gregory Scarpa crime family. And he was selling drugs. And he was bribing me. I was playing the part of a corrupt lieutenant who was protecting his drug operation. And when he eventually was arrested, I wanted it to be made very clear to him that I was not a corrupt lieutenant that got caught doing something wrong and then turned and became an informant and ratted on him. Because the rules change at that point. If you're an informant and you tell and have someone arrested, they feel that that's a legitimate time to whack you, to kill you, to murder you. There's no problem with killing me then. But if I'm a police officer and I'm doing my job, and they get caught, this is an unwritten law, and I believe it's true, that there will be no contract out on me in that particular instant. That's why I told them who I really was.
Vincent Murano is my guest, and his new book, Cop Hunter, is about his years investigating corruption and crime on the New York City police force. He served in the Internal Affairs Division and retired in 1986. Did you feel that the brass in the police department tried to prevent certain crimes from being uncovered because it would make the department look bad?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, I'm critical of the Internal Affairs Division, and I think in a fair way. But, you know, there was no cover-up for the sake of a cover-up. There was some incompetence. There was some maybe not caring attitude. And there was some concern over publicity, that's for sure. You know, you got to remember that even though it's internal affairs, it's still part of the police department. And they all answer to the same police commissioner. So when 12 cops get indicted, heads are going to roll. I mean, there's no question about it. So they sort of protect their own.
You know, listening to you talk about your work undercover, I can't help but think that there was some enjoyment you had hanging out with the mobsters and dressing and talking like one yourself. I'm not to make light of how dangerous it was and how important the job was, but...
What do you ask me? Did I like what I... Sure, I liked what I did. I liked it. I enjoyed the action. I enjoyed the danger, right? Not all the time. I mean, you know, there were times when I was concerned and worried about my family. When the contract was put out on me, it was a very difficult time for me. I had children that I was worried about. I was worried about, you know, these bombs they could put on your muffler in your car. It takes 2 seconds to hook it up.
These were some criminals who put a contract out on your life.
Sure. I mean, yeah. So there were difficult times. But, you know, out in what they called on the set is the word they use. I loved it.
So what have you been doing since you retired?
Well, I was a salesman for a short while I was writing the book. Now that the book is finished, I'm very fortunate. I'm going to be writing a second book, which should be hopefully done in a couple of years, about a novel, actually. It's about some character I invented. I think it's very interesting, and we'll see what happens. I am retired under what they call the Hart Bill, which means, you know, I had two heart attacks, so the pension is something you could live with. I mean, it's a decent pension. It's three quarters of my last year's pay, and it's also tax free. So, you know, I could survive. I'm not a big spender, and I'm not a gambler or a big drinker or a carouser about town. I'm just I'm a homebody type person, really. I enjoy putting along in my grass and shrubs and play a little golf, and that's all, really. And writing books now. I guess that's what I'm going to be doing, hopefully.
When you were working with IAD and you had to convince someone that you really were a cop,
mm-hmm.
That this criminal stuff was just an undercover disguise, would
yes.
you have any way of doing it? I mean, you're not carrying a badge with you when you're undercover.
Well, I would make sure. See, most policemen that we arrested were either at the special prosecutor's office or in the Internal Affairs Division. Now, if I arrested someone, if I knew the arrest was going to happen, and usually you do in these kind of cases, that's not the type of a thing where you or someone comes running out of a bank with a gun and you rob them, you know, arrest them. These things are indictments; they're planned. And you know, when the arrest goes down, most of the time I am there, and I do have my shield, and I do make sure
right.
that they know who I am. I am Detective Vincent Morano from the Internal Affairs Division. You're under arrest, or a lieutenant made the arrest, or someone else made the arrest. I'll make sure I was there if I could. You know, I'd make sure this is who I am. You were arrested for this, this, and this, and I am a detective. I work undercover, and you're in, buddy.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Nice meeting you.
My guest has been Vincent Morano, and his new book, Cop Hunter, is about his years with the Internal Affairs Division of New York City's police force. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.